Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is painter Suzanne Onodera. Onodera received her arts education at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago and the California College of Arts in Oakland, California. Her work has been exhibited in many galleries and art spaces around the country, including the Tang Gallery in Arizona, the Morris Graves Museum of Art in Eureka, California, the Joyce Gordon Gallery in Oakland, California, and in September, she will have a solo show at the Corners Gallery in Ithaca, New York. She has been awarded residencies at many art centers, including the Millay Colony for the Arts and the Vermont Studio Center. She is represented by Seeger Gray Gallery in Mill Valley, California, and Corners Gallery in Ithaca, New York, among others. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tish. It's nice to be here.
Now, you were brought up in Berkeley by a single mother who liked to travel, very spiritual, spirited. Tell us about that upbringing and how it informed some of your art.
Well, my older sister and I we spent a lot of time alone and with very little resources, meaning toys and summer camp. And so we ended up making up a lot of games and fantasy worlds, and we played with what we could create, whether it was shopping carts or books of paper and cut up into little fantasy worlds. My sister has always been very creative. She ended up being a filmmaker, and so we also walked about four blocks to the UC Berkeley Theater and saw films. There was a rep theater, so every night there was a different film.
Wow.
And since we spent a lot of time alone, my mother was working and going to school, it was this sort of endless sense of freedom that we had. And I really believe that that helped to cultivate both of our careers as artists, not as free thinkers per se, but more as creative thinkers.
Yeah, you had to figure out how to entertain yourselves.
Exactly.
And that's interesting.
Exactly. And we spent a lot of time also in the kitchen cooking. And somebody might think, oh, well, that's just, you know,
par for the course.
Yeah,
yeah.
To survive. But we would bake these incredible cakes and pies and silly things. Again, an extension of our need to create and being together. We were companions.
Uh-huh. Well, you started your creative world as an environmental artist in the Bay Area computer games world. Tell us about that. I haven't met very many women who got in on the early days of that.
Right. When I look back on it, for me, it feels very natural. Like, of course, that was a natural progression for me as an artist who loved to draw in my sketchbooks and even at a very early age just constantly drawing these bizarre characters
in
worlds and making up stories. And then when I graduated from college, you know, most people would think, especially in the 80s, that there wasn't much hope for someone who had an arts degree, a degree in fine art.
Yeah.
Graphic arts is different, architecture. But we were all just, oh, we're all going to be waiting tables or pumping gas. And some did, and that's fine. But it was just a stroke of luck that I had a roommate who loved to play video games. And this was early on. This is the early 90s.
Uh-huh.
And he looked at my sketchbook and he said, you know, Suzanne, you can actually get paid to draw these creatures and these fantastic worlds. And I thought, well, I don't even know how to turn a computer on. He goes, don't worry about it. They'll teach you everything. And I had no idea that it was a male-dominated industry. I had no idea what it was like to work in an office building, sitting in a cube. You know, it was a totally different reality.
And it was just inventing itself then,
it was
too.
Really,
so it wasn't known as a male-dominated world at that point.
And I have to say, everybody that I worked with for all of those years, there was never really a sense of, oh, you're a girl, so you can't do this.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were constantly inventing something new, and they had to be open to new ideas and new people and new personalities because, let's face it, it was the industry and it's the culture where all of the geeky kids in high school, if you remember, all the geeky kids in high school ended up getting into computers and games and programming. We were the kids who played with ourselves at recess. We didn't have that many friends. We weren't distracted by social, you know, events because we were the geeky kids.
Yeah, and you were creating new worlds
right,
in so many ways.
Right.
How fascinating
so
that is.
So it was a great time because, you know, you're working with these guys who went to MIT in physics or computer programming, and they're inventing these tools, and you're working within these realms that are yet to be discovered. And so anything goes. And it was a fantastic time. The burnout rate is very, very high. And as I got older, I realized, oh, I probably won't be able to work 12 hours a day.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
and
6 days
probably,
a week.
You probably lose the excitement of it, too. It must have been so exciting in those early days.
It was, and I think that also as it became more and more popular and commercial, that excitement was drained out of it for the dollar advantage for these companies, these larger companies who were scooping up the smaller companies with all the original ideas. And that's just the evolution of products, you know.
I want to talk about the fact that you eventually ended up working on the James Bond franchise as an artist. Tell us about that. That's fascinating to me, too.
Right. I had the great advantage of working on a couple of different titles, one at another company, a Star Trek franchise, which I grew up watching Star Trek and, again, influenced by these fantasy worlds. And it was such a pleasure to work at George Lucas's company doing Star Wars later. And then at a third company working on James Bond, which, again, Ian Fleming's books we read when we were kids, my sister and I. And so it was like, I'm an adult, but I get to live in these fantasy worlds that I grew up playing with or imagining.
Uh-huh. And what did you do for these Bond? What were you doing, background scenery?
Right. I was an environment artist. And so what you do is you create the space in which the characters and the stories play out. And so everything from, say, that chair to that coffee cup, you have to either model or you give to another artist to model, and then you texture it, meaning you paint it to look real. You work with the lighting designers to make the space after it's been painted, basically textured, to look even more real. And so when you enter those environments, you feel like you're there. And I think it's, you know, it's a fantastic, sort of bizarre.
I was going to say, that must be do something to your head, though.
It does do something to your head. And
So until you make it look real, it's not real, huh?
Exactly. It's just flat polygon spaces, whitewashed spaces, gray tones, and characters running through who are just skeletal, you know, elements doing things. And I also have to say that I was also really lucky not to work on any titles that were really, really overtly violent or, you know, against my sort of beliefs. And I think I got out at a good time because they did get more violent, the games. And there aren't as many titles that are interesting to women either. And I really looked at more game companies that were being run by women or working on games for young female teens. Mm-hmm. And there just aren't very many.
Yeah.
And so I realized it was a good time to get out.
Yeah. I actually want to talk about the fact that in 2004 is when you started to decide to change your life, become a painter. Can you tell us a little bit about what precipitated that? It was a tragic event.
I had been thinking, there's got to be something else that I can do in my life to create more balance. Working so much and feeling more distance from who you really are was a scary feeling as you got older. Because as you get older, you're supposed to know more about yourself. But in fact, I felt like I was losing myself for the corporate sphere. And I started painting more when I could on the weekends and on vacations and set up a studio in the back of my home in the Bay Area. And I had started to meet more and more friends who were doing painting full time, realizing that this possibly could be something that I could do. And I had a good friend whose career was just starting to take off in the Bay Area. And he was getting ready for his first big solo show, not at a major gallery, but still, it was significant for him.
Yeah.
And he, on his way to hang that show in the morning on a weekday, he got in a huge car accident on the Bay Bridge, and he and his partner died in this car accident.
Oh, God.
And I actually didn't find out about it until the day of the show. I went to the show.
Oh, my God.
Giving him space to do his work. I went to the show, and his work wasn't there. And I had no way to reach his family. He was sort of estranged from his family. Anyway, I eventually found out what had happened. And it was very tragic. And I thought, you know, if I don't do what I feel like I need to do now, when am I ever going to do it? So I need to at least try. And that's when I quit and came in on a Tuesday morning and wrote a letter and said, you know, I just need to pursue something else. It could be 3 months, it could be 6 months. Just give me a chance to do it. And it's been 10 years.
What a great story that precipitated something so beautiful for you to pursue.
Exactly.
Now, I want to quote you. When you went back backpacking in Northern Europe. You said you came back and decided you needed to be an artist in the world, not just within one's own zip code.
Right.
Tell us about that.
You know, travel, I think, is something that I've always loved as a child. It was a very different experience as a child because my perception of travel was just a crazy, wild, sort of Mr. Toad's wild ride, you know, and sleeping on suitcases and doing what we could to get by. It wasn't glamorous or anything.
Uh-huh.
And then I realized I wanted to see some paintings and some work that do not leave these Northern European cities and other places in the world. And the only way I could see those paintings was to go there. And first time traveling alone, female with a backpack, everyone said, oh my gosh, don't do it. You are setting yourself up. This is horrible, you know. And I thought, well, you know, I'll put a big pink bubble around myself and I'll be fine. And I was. And I met great people. I saw amazing art. And I think when you're an artist, it's important to also do things on your own because you want to be given that time to really experience it as a whole, and go back four times.
You know what? I lived in Amsterdam in the early 90s. I swear, seeing Van Gogh and some of those paintings live in person so changed me.
I know.
It's so opened my mind to so many things.
And I think as a tourist, to have a point of departure when you go there of some sort of purpose is huge, and it was huge for me. And so when I came back, or when I was on the plane coming back, actually, I was very sad. I thought, how can I bring these experiences into my everyday life, whether it's meeting new people, but also just making my art that is somehow going to have this presence in the world that's going to give back this eternal kind of amazing beauty and will live on for centuries. Mm-hmm. And that's what I got out of it. And that's what I mean by not in a zip code, because the survival of an artist is not necessarily just a financial survival. It's your work needs to survive.
Yeah.
And that's what I got out of that trip.
What an amazing, amazing opening.
Yeah, it was.
Now, your landscapes almost always focus on water.
Mm.
Can you tell us why? Are you obsessed with water? Is it part of your soul? Does it invoke emotion? Tell us.
That's an interesting observation. Growing up in the Bay Area, right there by the bay, which is a huge mass of water, and it's beautiful and scary at the same time. It's intimidating. It's deep. It's dark. It's cold. It's massive. There's mm-hmm. fog that rolls over it, and it's the sun hits it, and it's blinding. Here, the water is everywhere. Whether we like it or not,
exactly,
it's everywhere.
Exactly.
It rains a lot here. I love the seasons here. The Bay Area, it is just that mass of water, and it's isolated. And then there are these masses of land surrounding it that are very dry, especially now, scorched, burned. And I find that contrast to be fascinating, textually and spiritually and subjectively. It's just like there's so many metaphors in water.
And I
sometimes I'm painting bodies of water, but then it turns into something else. It's murk, and it's not so soothing.
I actually see a lot of light in the murk in your paintings. So then, your paintings are amazing, by the way, Suzanne. They really bring out so much emotion.
I like that light in the murk, and really the way I paint, there are so many layers. I think of it as almost as a novel, where there's layers in a story. So you see a green and a pink and a blue and an orange reading through all of those pages that come to the final end of the chapter, and it's one conclusive story. And all of those pieces work together to create this harmony. And so you'll see light in the murk, or you'll see fog in the sun, or you'll see the sunset. Or is it the dawn? And I like to keep things a little ambiguous because maybe I don't know, but it is fascinating.
If you're just joining us, my guest is painter Suzanne Onodera. We're talking about some of her beautiful landscape impressionist paintings. Were you always attracted to impressionistic art, or did you ever do realism?
When I was in college, I originally started as a drawing major and sort of a hyper-realistic style, and mostly because I believed that I needed to learn how to draw first before I could really get crazy with paint.
Yeah.
And it was very satisfying to learn how to look at the human form or to look at form in general and to try to capture the spirit of someone's face. And as I progressed through my education, I realized that paint was just another way to express yourself. It was a deeper, more fertile way rather than a line. Line can carry so much expression, but so can paint. No, I haven't always been an impressionistic painter. I really actually wouldn't think of myself as impressionistic, but I don't really know how to categorize my work. I have a lot of influences, for example, like Mark Rothko, who is an abstract expressionist who's really seen as an abstract artist. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I love the spiritualness in his paintings, and I love the mood that they evoke. When I think of Impressionism, I think more just about light and capturing that fleeting sense of light.
Well, see, that's what I get from your paintings. Mm. For me, it captures something that's concrete.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like it's, you know,
specific.
Yeah, it doesn't look abstract to me. It looks more impressionistic of water and the land and your emotions.
Right, and I think that's the beauty about something I'm trying to capture in my work, is that each person who sees it takes something away that's very personal, or brings something that's very personal to the vision. And that's the growth of the work. You know, once it leaves my studio and it's in your possession or someone else's possession, it becomes who they want it to be. Mm-hmm. That the Indian Ocean in the spring, or
you know,
the Bay Area in the winter.
Yeah,
and that's
the best
powerful.
Thing about it is you can project your own life onto these works.
And I think that's really success. You know, the sign that a piece is working for me is that it's detaching from my vision, and it becomes something else, bigger.
It has another life
outside
of you.
Right.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm really not interested in illustrating a particular place or a time or a historic moment. And also that leaves it open to avenues of interpretation.
Yeah. You say that you work every day in your studio at 8:30 in the morning, no matter what. You feel like you need to work out just like a athlete or a dancer or a musician and practice.
That's true. There have been times when I have not been able to be in the studio for different reasons. And I always feel like you're getting back on the bike, but the tires are missing, you know? It's like, I know what I'm doing, but something's really wrong.
And
you have to practice. Art is not any different than learning a language or playing an instrument or being an athlete. Now, certainly any of those things, you can go beyond and hurt yourself. So you do have to constantly check in with your physical side, your mental side. Your motivation, is it the motivation to make money or just make art? You know, you really have to do some check-ins. And I think that when I say I check into the studio, it's almost like I'm checking in with myself. And it is a solitary space. It's not just a social place. It's a place where I find very deep satisfaction and meditation in my work. And it is a practice. It is a way of checking in with my soul, really, every single day.
And do you stay in the quiet, or are you an artist that listens to music? How do you navigate?
In the quiet. You know, there have been times when I go on these NPR rages, and I listen to the radio, and I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, the world is just such a wreck. And then I turn off the radio.
Uh-huh.
Silence is, it gives me the ability to open my mind. And sometimes those other voices come in, and it's hard to stamp them out. And if it's politics or if it's someone else's opinion, it stays with you for the rest of the day. And it can be very toxic. I love listening to music. I love listening to classical music and jazz and loud music, too. But I'm also I try to be very conscientious about the other tenants in the building where I work. And so it's hard being an artist because there are so many stereotypes that people believe that you're going to be really loud and really messy. And so I'm
or a recluse. You know, I mean, some people think artists are recluses and kind of weird.
A creep. Know. Yeah.
What is she really doing?
Right. Oh, it's that creep down
with her
the hall.
Paintbrushes. Yeah. Do you paint from memory? Do you ever paint from photographs? How do you elicit some of these beautiful images?
I mostly paint from memory. One of the reasons why I left California was I was really tired of being in the car all the time.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
Also, there's just so many people. Here I find that I can walk and feel safe and be absorbed by and taken by all of this beauty. So I try to walk everywhere, and I really enjoy not being in the car. Even when it's snowing, even when it's 0 degrees outside, I'm walking to the studio. And I've got this ridiculous
grin on my face. See, Suzanne, you really are a weirdo.
I'm the creep. And I've got this great look on my face. Like, I just love watching everything change and evolve through the seasons. So I absorb that. I try to look at a lot of different things, whether it's architecture, whether it's... you know, random comic books or magazines or old paintings or new paintings. I try to just constantly feed the brain. And when I'm in the studio, I do have stacks of books that I like, you know, that I love, that I'm always referring to. But it's more just to confirm that, oh, yeah, I'm doing something that's important to me. And so I don't feel so isolated. It's almost like the books are my friends.
Yeah.
And they're keeping me company.
You know, that's interesting to me, because when I moved here, I was thinking the change of seasons would be good for my soul. It was something that I kept saying, it's good for your soul. And
right.
and it is. It's such an amazing transformation. And then the thought of a painter being able to absorb all that is fascinating.
Right. And so I'm not really out in the world setting up my easel by the creek. I guess I'm just a little more private. I'm not really into the spectacle of painting. And so I'll collect things in my mind, in my vision, with my little camera, and then I'll go back to the studio and go, aha, maybe that's an interesting shape, or that's an interesting color, or look how that purple turns into pink. So it's a collective sort of resource that I'm grabbing from.
You know, you say in your biography how one of the things that you have to be careful of is not getting isolated. And that's something that a lot of artists have to deal with. So what do you do, actually? Do you go out and have a social life and just leave painting behind sometimes?
I do. I try. It's a struggle, especially because it's my main source of income is painting. And I have to treat it like a job, because if I'm not in the studio making something, and just to boil it down to the very end, the very base reality is, if I'm not making stuff, I'm not making a living. Because I don't teach and I don't sew potholders, you know, or something, some kind of other product. I have to be creating all the time, but and I don't want it to be drudgery either. So I have to give myself that space to, whether it's go take a bicycle ride or go hang out with friends in their dining room and eat pizza.
But are you always thinking about painting when you're doing that?
I hate to say it, but I am. You know, when I wake up in the morning, I'm thinking about painting. When I go to sleep at night, I'm thinking about painting. And they're not always good thoughts. Sometimes they're like, oh, I am such a failure. Or, oh, that... brown, I'm just using way too much brown.
Do you get up in the middle of the night and go, okay, I got to go fix this canvas in my studio right now?
Oh, no. Well, you know, the good thing, that's an interesting point. My studio is not, it's about 7 blocks away from my home.
Oh, good.
And I think that's very healthy.
That is.
I've had both situations. I've had a lot of different studio situations, from the worst to the most fantastic. And this has been great, because I can walk. It's a good amount of distance away from the home, and so I'm unplugged while I'm there. I don't have Wi-Fi. I don't bring my computer unless I'm just typing. I can't access any of that. Facebook, you know, gone.
That's perfect.
And then so in the middle of the night, if I do wake up, I have to just be in the moment, try to get myself back to sleep, try to think about something positive. And, you know, to have that distance from your work.
So you really leave your work at work.
Yes.
So that you have time for a real life.
It is. And I go home for lunch, and sometimes I bring my lunch to the studio, but I go home and I try to, you know, take care of some email. But it is contained.
Yeah.
And those are the moments that I do these things. Otherwise, it's chaos.
Oh, I'll
it's
bet.
Anarchy.
It is. It is anarchy of your spirit.
Right.
I've talked to a lot of artists about the fact that nowadays in modern times, artists have to learn how to sell themselves.
That's right.
How do you deal with that aspect of it? It PR is so hard for most artists.
It is, and I wouldn't say that I'm very good at it. I think that a lot of the things that I've experienced, the good and bad, have sort of just happened. And And maybe that's just the way life is. People have contacted me. So-and-so said so-and-so wants to contact you, and then it turns into a great opportunity. Mm. The galleries that I work with, who are they're all amazing, supportive people. You're in a relationship with these people.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's a lot of trust. And that sometimes you can't force that. It has to happen naturally. Uh-huh. And I've been lucky that a lot of my relationships have been natural. And they come and go, but really the thing that you're left with, which is your experience, and you take that with you to the next thing that happens. And I think being open to opportunities and trusting in yourself that you're going to make the right choice and not just do something crazy, yeah, like send out 500, you know, packets that cost you a lot of money to 500 galleries that really are not interested in what you do.
Yeah, yeah.
So
that is a panic mode, isn't it?
It is a panic mode. And I think coming from a place of knowing you, yourself, and how you work and your ability to make the work, I think is a huge step in terms of marketing yourself, if you want to use that term, marketing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm constantly thinking, oh, I've got to get a new business card and I've got to do this. But really, those are the small things. What keeps you floating is your positive spirit and your ability to make the work that has soul, you know. And that's going to carry you a lot further than the marketing plan, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it seems to have been working for you. Now, we only have a couple of minutes left, Suzanne. As we've been talking about, you moved from Northern California to the Ithaca Finger Lakes region. How has this changed you as an artist, if at all?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask that question.
Really? Yeah.
Process can seem so slow, and growth in one's life can seem so slow. You can look back on 10 years and say, oh, I was such a different person 10 years ago. But it also sometimes seems like it was just a few years ago. So I've only been here for 4 years. I'm going on 5 years, and I really couldn't say exactly how it's changed my work. But just the fact that you've noticed that there's so much water, there's this sense of water, there's this bigger sense of atmosphere, I think now I realize that that has changed in my work. There is probably a more expansive feeling also in my work. My work,
that freedom thing?
It doesn't feel so caged, if that's a good description. I feel a little more interested in things that I've never been interested before in. And I know that's just the exposure of being in a totally different place and not knowing what's going on, you know? I mean, 6 blocks outside of my little sphere, I'm like, wow, look, cornfields.
Yeah, I know. Isn't
and
it
so
amazing?
Every little thing like that to me is fascinating. And I've been working on a project with Bridget Meads, who is a poet here in town, and we would go on these like 2-hour hikes in the Finger Lakes National Forest. And I would say, oh my gosh, look at all these butterflies. Look at the way the sun comes through the trees. And everything's like a new experience for me. So
yeah,
I'm
wonderful.
Sure, absolutely sure that it's manifesting in my work in some sort of positive way.
Can you give us some contact information for our listeners?
Right. Well, you can find me online on my website, sonodera.com. So it's my first initial, S, and my last name, O-N-O-D-E-R-A.com. And that's my website. Of course, they can reach me through the Corners Gallery here in Ithaca. I'm on her new updated website, but mostly just Googling will suffice.
Yeah, yeah. So. Well, Suzanne Onodero, thank you so much for joining us. This is a fascinating conversation, and we do look forward to a solo show sometime in the fall.
It's
at
September.
The Corners, September.
Yes.
Corners Gallery.
Great. Thank you, Tess.
Suzanne Onodero, thank you so much. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.